From Jeannette to Camp Hill, Erie to Philadelphia, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, the first year of a legislative session is always busy, and 2019 was no exception. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association and Rebecca Euler from the National Federation of Independent Business are here with the year in review. And fake news is real, and State Representative Frank Ryan of Lebanon County got firsthand experience in dealing with it in the aftermath of legislation that recently passed the House. He is here with a Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry. Happy New Year, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to David Taylor and Rebecca Euler in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. 2020, of course, is a presidential election year. A third of the U.S. Senate, which does not include either of Pennsylvania's U.S. senators, are also up for election, as are all members of the U.S. House of Representatives. There are congressional races in Pennsylvania, and the candidates are lining up. The 8th Congressional District in northeastern Pennsylvania is expected to be one of the most hotly contested races, as incumbent Democrat Matt Cartwright will be seeking a new term in a district that heavily supported Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential race. Earl Granville, a decorated war veteran who lost a leg in Afghanistan, has announced his candidacy for the Republican nomination to challenge Cartwright. Two other Republicans already in the race include Teddy Daniels, a former police officer, and Luzerne County Councilman Harry Hawes. Meanwhile, across the state in the 3rd Congressional District that encompasses northwestern Pennsylvania, a third Democrat has entered the race against incumbent Republican Congressman Mike Kelly. Edward DeSantis, who works in sales and finance, says he would like the opportunity to take on Kelly in the November general election. To do that, he must first prevail over his primary opponents, who include Daniel Smith Jr., a bank manager, and Erie teacher Christy Grebus. And one person who isn't running in 2020 is Governor Tom Wolf, who shut down speculation he was angling for the Democratic Party's vice presidential nomination. In a media interview before Christmas, Wolf ruled out such a candidacy, saying it is an, quote, absolute no. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. While 2019 was a busy year in Harrisburg as lawmakers passed several significant pieces of legislation and actually got the state budget done on time, here with a Capital Watch look at what did and what did not happen are David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association and Rebecca Euler from the National Federation of Independent Business. David?
And welcome once again to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, Rebecca Euler, Legislative Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. Rebecca, it's a pleasure to have you.
It's great to be here. You make me sound so exciting, David. Thank you.
Absolutely. Except no substitute. It's a one and only, Rebecca. And, you know, it's been a long year. And, you know, working together, we've seen a lot come and go in 2019. And so as we're here wrapping up the year, it's probably a good time to look back and consider the year that was.
Sure, that sounds good.
We had, I think, one of the things that set the tone was the strong overall performance of the economy. I would credit most of that to the reforms at the federal level, but the fact that we have a burgeoning energy sector continuing to lift Pennsylvania's economy, it's kept us in positive territory all year. It's driven unemployment down to historic lows, and that as a result, the economy has thrown off lots of tax revenue, and that has helped Harrisburg to close the gap. It's made the budget process less painful than it might otherwise have been.
Yeah, absolutely. Revenues are up. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act has had an impact in Pennsylvania. Business, especially small businesses, we can tell you at NFIB are thriving. They're doing really well. Your Main Street businesses are happy. They're happy with the tax cuts in Washington and with regulatory reform that's coming down from Washington. So all those things have worked really well, have come together in Pennsylvania to help out our state budget picture.
I would, look back on 2019 and in my opinion, the most important thing, the most important accomplishment was the successful defense of Pennsylvania's system of competitive markets for electricity, that despite the very expensive and all-encompassing lobbying efforts from the nuclear power industry for a nuclear bailout, that we held the line. And so as a result, whereas Illinois and Ohio and New York and New Jersey have overturned competitive markets, that they're subsidizing nuclear, it's jacking up prices for the ratepayers, that in Pennsylvania, because we didn't do that, that as a result, we're going to still be in the running for potential energy investments that will increase generation and, and increase the resilience of the grid and keep prices low for all Pennsylvania consumers. So we essentially won by not losing.
Absolutely. The competitive energy market, no doubt, has an impact because it keeps energy prices down for all consumers, including businesses who are willing to take are able to take advantage of those competitive rates. So that was absolutely a victory this year.
So what were the things that you were working on, Rebecca?
Well, one of the things that I wanted to talk a little bit about is we know that the biggest concern of small businesses, and in fact, really all businesses at the moment, is finding qualified employees.
That's correct.
And we know that it actually may be holding back growth. We could be doing even better in the state if our businesses were able to find the employees that they need. So one thing I want to talk briefly about is the fact that the legislature understands this, and I think they have focused on various workforce development efforts this year. There have been a number of reforms that were passed. I think the value of career and technical education, of trade skills, of job training, apprenticeships, those sorts of things are really starting to have an impact. We've had a couple of reforms passed along those lines. So I think the sort of renewed focus on workforce has been a really positive thing this year.
I would agree completely, and it seems also that there is a consensus coalescing around this, that
yes,
this is something where, it's not just the business community, but the governor and the legislators on both sides of the aisle in both chambers recognizing that that this is a crisis. It's a workforce crisis. And I believe that that your suspicions are correct, that the inability of employers to find a sufficient number of qualified new hires really is holding back growth. That you can't, you can't bid for more work. You can't add a third shift if you don't have the capacity in terms of your staff. And also, just again for the reference of the listeners, at any given time there are about 6,000 open positions with Pennsylvania manufacturers. So the jobs are there. It's a matter of matching up people who have the right skills, the right kinds of abilities, with those open positions.
Another thing maybe we want to talk about is the fact that despite the continuing efforts by the governor and others to raise taxes in Pennsylvania, we got a budget this year that did not raise taxes again. And that's in part due to the economic growth that we're seeing and the success of the economy in general. But no new taxes is always a good thing, too.
Yeah, they spent more than we had, had to cobble things together. And that there's been, yes, they did put a little bit of money into the rainy day fund. You'll hear a lot about that. But in effect, it was enough money to keep state government operating for about 12 hours.
Yeah.
So
right.
So we shouldn't congratulate ourselves too highly for that really mostly symbolic contribution to the state's reserves.
Well, if you want to sort of take that and shift to some of the more negative things that happened this year, the, like you said, the overspending, the governor overspending last year is continuing into this year. So spending beyond what was initially budgeted and approved by the legislature, but actually continuing to spend beyond those amounts. And I think it's due this year. The analysts have said that it's going to be about $1 billion more this year the governor will spend that was not budgeted, not approved by the General Assembly.
How is that even possible?
It shouldn't be possible, but it's one of those things that continually happens here over the past couple of years. And the legislature is going to have to deal with it when they deal with the budget in
the
spring.
Yeah. The contribution that Pennsylvania is making to the national energy portfolio is really astonishing. So, as the listeners have heard me say, Pennsylvania is now the number two producer of natural gas in America and that our contribution has helped make America number one in the world. But the you know, we are not a distant second behind Texas. That in fact, between Texas and Pennsylvania, we produce half of America's natural gas, which of course is, again, the America's number one in the world. But in 2018, Pennsylvania produced almost as much natural gas as Texas did in 2017.
Wow.
So like we are closing in, and if we continue to grow, it's entirely possible that we could overtake Texas as number one.
That's incredible.
It's big stuff.
Well, I'm old enough to remember back, you know, decades ago when we used to talk about the dream of energy independence. And here we are. And it's amazing. Here we are. We're energy independent as a nation. We're exporting energy. And Pennsylvania is an enormous part of that. So I'm really proud of our state in that regard.
And me too. And again, it's the moment when on one side of the political divide that you have people calling for an end to our energy production. And it's just, it's like, why now? Why when we finally attain these long-term goals would you pull the plug on that? It certainly makes no sense to me.
Well, along those lines, I mean, one of the things that happened this year is Governor Wolf committed us to joining the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative.
Oh, the carbon tax.
Right. Exactly. That's what it is. And it would be a cap and trade program on carbon used for energy production, which, of course, is what we're talking about here. Natural gas used for energy production is part of the big reason why our energy prices are low here in Pennsylvania. And we're really benefiting from that. But by signing on to a cap and trade agreement, or like you said, an energy tax, basically, that really, I'm not sure why we would want to shoot ourselves in the foot.
Well, and I'm going to need to do the deep dive on this one. So
okay.
Buckle up. So this regional compact, I don't believe the governor has the authority to unilaterally enter us into it. But
because it's a tax.
It is a tax. And clearly the taxing authority under the Constitution, you know, rests with the legislature. If the executive has the power to tax, then we have, you know, unitary government, and that's tyranny. But moreover, you know, talking about the purpose of this compact is to reduce CO2
emissions.
Yeah. And well, the fact is that Pennsylvania, over the years that this compact has existed, we have lowered our emissions to a greater degree than did the states that participate in the compact.
Yes.
And that this cap and trade thing, that the states get credit for the reductions that they make. For us to join that process now, after we've already made these dramatic reductions, we would get no credit. And essentially, all it would do would be you know, ripping off our own citizens. You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers. With me, Rebecca Euler from NFIB Pennsylvania.
No, you're absolutely right. The reduction in carbon emissions is one of the success stories of the gas revolution. And we're here to, you know, talk a little bit more about the successes that we've had this past year. And natural gas production has gone up in Pennsylvania this past year. I think I saw a 9% increase just in the last quarter. So we are really on.
It's astonishing.
Yeah, it is. We're on a great ride here with natural gas, and we really need to do everything we can to continue it.
Well, and I guess one of the landmark things that I would point to from 2019. Looking back, would be the Energize PA agenda that Speaker Terzai queued up in the PA House, and that a number of those bills actually have become law. But the focus here is how do we maximize the in-state use of this Pennsylvania resource so that we can capture as much of the downstream value as possible? How do we get this this energy and the byproducts, you know, to the downstream consumers who can benefit from it? How do we encourage more businesses, more residences to make use of this Pennsylvania resource? And again, to capture as much of that value in state as possible.
Yeah, and I believe the Energize PA proposal was just an alternative to actually taxing natural gas. From those who believe that growing the economy is
yes.
better than actually
yes.
Levying a tax on our gas production.
Yeah, and again, and to be specific, you know, Rebecca, it's a new punitive industry-specific tax on top of all of the other taxes that that this sector pays. And back in November, the lieutenant governor was speaking at the Pennsylvania Press Club, and he was again saying that Pennsylvania needs this new industry-specific severance tax because Texas has it. Well, what goes unsaid is that Texas has no personal income tax, no corporate net income tax. It's got billions of dollars of state-of-the-art infrastructure. They've got streamlined permitting and a mature legal and regulatory climate. They've enacted meaningful limits on lawsuit abuse, and they have no impact fee. So, you know, this has been a deeply dispiriting conversation that we've been having because it's just so fundamentally dishonest.
Right. Imagine where we could be. You just said we're chasing Texas on energy production. Imagine where we could be if we actually could compete in all those other areas.
Yeah, it's amazing. So looking back, what other highlights reflecting on the year gone by?
Well, I think sort of dovetailing with we were just talking about energy production and the need for regulatory reform. You were talking about how in Texas the regulatory burden isn't quite as high. Getting permits is a little easier.
There's a permit you can get. You can get permits in Texas in one business day that in Pennsylvania will take you 3 months. And that's if you're lucky.
Yeah. So regulatory reform, we haven't made a lot of progress there yet. There hasn't been too many bills passed that help, but it is getting some attention, and I think in some ways some bipartisan attention that we have a problem. So a couple of bills have passed the House. They're on to the Senate, and I know there are some hearings planned in the Senate on some of these regulatory reform initiatives. So I'm hoping that we're going to get some wind under the sails of regulatory reform, which we can move on next year. But that has started this year, so hopefully we can pursue those.
And, you know, and again, no one is saying that there shouldn't be rules. Of course there should be rules. We're just saying that those regulations should make sense, that they should be based on sound science, that they should be subjected to some kind of meaningful, independent cost-benefit analysis,
right,
just to make sure that the good that comes from the regulations is greater than the costs that are being imposed on the economy.
Now, currently, it's the agency that's proposing the regulation that estimates the costs involved.
Yes.
And they don't always consider the cost to the regulated sector accurately. Right.
The proverbial fox watching the hen house.
Exactly. Yeah.
Just an additional thought that I wanted to tack on to what we were describing earlier with the workforce and you know, that we had the you know, the governor institute a workforce command center, you know, as you mentioned, I think that there's a growing, you know, consensus, a mindfulness among all the stakeholders, recognizing that we need more people to be ready to take up the jobs that are present in our economy. But even though people might think of this as a separate issue, I really believe it's a related issue, and that is the issue of corrections reform. That there have been, you know, a number of measures about, you know, the clean slate legislation, other things, recognizing that we as a society must do more to help people who have paid their debt to society to be able to reintegrate into everyday life, and in particular that our economy needs the contributions that that these folks have to offer. And so, you know, at the same time that we think of you know, the workforce crisis as being primarily a you know, a job training you know, skills issue, it's really much broader than that. That I think that this is also a, you know, again, a corrections issue, a welfare reform issue, an issue regarding breaking addiction, and again, helping people to return to productive life and the dignity and self-sufficiency that can only come from that.
Right. I think part of I agree with all of that. Part of the discussion has been lately about licensing reform, where where certain folks who have just, you know, trying to get their lives back together weren't able to get professional licenses from the state because of regulatory burdens relating to good moral character, I think is the the phrase they use in the statute. So there's been a lot of discussion over how to reform that so that so folks are not prevented from being given opportunities to work in their field and get state licenses. So I think that's important
to clarify that people who are repentant and people who've paid their debt can be you know, deemed to be good citizens. And also additionally is it good and necessary for the Commonwealth to require licenses for all of these different professions and to the degree that we have them today? You know, does it really require a license to cut hair or to, I think the worst one, we don't have this, but there's another state where you have to have a license to arrange flowers. so knocking down some of these paperwork barriers is a way to ease the path for people to return to productive life.
That would be great.
So looking forward, just in the last moments that we have, Rebecca, what are your hopes for 2020? I know it's an election year, and so the political fever will be rising. I think about next year and maybe just a budget that doesn't raise taxes, that is, within the parameters of what the legislators, what the Commonwealth takes in. Can we spend no more than what we take in and not raise taxes on people? That would be a great goal for 2020.
Right. I agree. And I know there is some discussion in the legislature about what kind of tax reforms may be able to be put on the table early next year, if there are any sort of reducing of the tax burden for our businesses and for our citizens. That would be really nice to look at. Hopefully we can get there at some
point
soon.
Absolutely. And we need the politicians to prioritize tax reductions to the same degree that they prioritize new spending, because there are places where government is in the way, and by lowering rates, we can increase collections by increasing growth. So,
absolutely.
Anyway, well, that's all the time we have. It's been a lovely year getting to be on the program with you, Rebecca. Thank you for all of that. Where can people go to learn more about you and your group and the things that you're doing?
Well, thank you, David. Our website is nfib.com/PA or on Facebook or Twitter.
Excellent. Excellent. And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org and on the Pennsylvania Cable Network Sunday mornings at 8:30 with PMA Perspective. So from Rebecca and me, thanks very much for listening. Happy New Year, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a Lincoln Radio Journal commentary from Frank Ryan.
Imagine the headlines. Pennsylvania representative responsible for Senator Kamala Harris dropping out of the presidential race just 3 days after Senator Harris posted an article that was grossly inaccurate about a bill that I had introduced in the Pennsylvania legislature, she dropped out of her presidential race. I was ecstatic that my controversial bill, which should not have been controversial at all, forced an end to her presidential dreams. Seriously, though, I was no more responsible for her dropping out of the race than she was accurate in describing my fetal remains bill. Fake news. I've heard President Trump make comments about fake news for almost 4 years now. Until recently, however, I had no idea how serious a problem fake news really is. By way of background, I am a current member of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. The setting for this story is quite benign. I introduced a bill, House Bill 1890, the Fetal Remains Bill, whose only purpose was to allow a parent who had lost a child through miscarriage or stillbirth to have the remains at their own expense to inter or cremate. I've had 3 children that have lost and are in heaven. My bill on fetal remains is similar to an Indiana law that the United States Supreme Court found to be constitutional this year by a 7-2 vote. My experience with fake news started almost immediately after the hearing about the bill in committee. First, a Democrat member of the Pennsylvania House made national news in reference to her comment that a miscarriage is nothing more than a mess on a napkin. She reluctantly seemed to apologize after public outcry, even from the left. At the same time, one member of the press latched onto some misleading information from a pro-abortion group and published a story that was grossly inaccurate, saying that the bill mandated death certificates and funerals. None of that is in my 3-page bill. Fake news. It seemed that in just days after the committee vote, I had managed to alienate Planned Parenthood, a Rolling Stone magazine reporter, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, and Senator Kamala Harris. Not a bad track record for a relatively new member of the House. The article that was originally published has since been updated after I got wind of the article. I responded to critics of my bill and sent them a link to a 3-page bill which clarified the real objective of the bill to create the voluntary program for grieving parents to take care of the remains of stillbirth or miscarriage. After public backlash, the reporter met with me and our staff, and we refuted almost the entire original article. The article was revised, but the original article was not retracted per se. Incidentally, to be fair, the reporter reached out to me before publication, and I called her back immediately, but she indicated conveniently that she never received my message until after the article was published. After the initial outrage, the bill went to the full House for a vote, and it passed with a bipartisan vote of 123-76. Despite the language in the bill to the contrary, some members of the House continued the charade of mischaracterizing what the bill allowed despite continued correction. Fake news. Then the fun really started. Almost immediately, two articles were published which parroted the inaccurate information from the first article. Neither reporter called me for a comment. Hate mail started coming in, and I responded to as many as I could. The people who saw the article that I was able to respond to were overwhelmingly supportive of my bill after they saw the language in my bill. But the left continued. Senator Kamala Harris forwarded the article on Facebook, further causing some minor comments that I also responded to. Again, once people saw what the bill really did, most responded favorably. One person even posted the following, and I quote, "To individuals who are emotionally charged by PIE House Bill 1890, please read our exchange of comments. Information is healthy and emotions are real. Please be informed before you make an emotional outburst like I did today," end quote. Apparently, the left did not anticipate that I would respond to the comments and defend my bill, and hence the fake news is alive, and it is not well. The damage that is done by such irresponsible, agenda-driven reporting, and I quote, reporting, is remarkable. The damage, though, is not done to me, to President Trump, or others so affected, but it is to the very premise of the First Amendment of the Constitution. Freedom of the press is a right we should all cherish. Responsibility of the press is what we should all demand. Trump understands what the press does not. He understands that the vast majority of Americans cherish freedom of the press but condemn the irresponsibility of the press. There are outstanding reporters, however. In my own case on this bill, one reporter contacted me and said, "This article about your bill does not sound like you. Can you explain it?" I did, and she reported on the bill. To this day, I have no idea whether or not she supports the bill, but what I do understand is that she, the reporter who came to interview me, and the entire station cherish accuracy and trust. That is the true freedom of the press, and that should be cherished. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our website, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 24 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WANB AM and FM in Waynesburg, along with WAEB AM in Whitehall, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.
Thank you.